Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning and welcome to Speak Up for Tuesday, February 13th. It's World Radio Day today. I don't know, we're not doing a lot to celebrate here at CJSF, although we should because it's also our birthday here at CJSF. Welcome to the program. My name is Magnus Teeval. With me today is
Peter Haskell. I'm usually here Mondays, but I'm here Tuesday.
But Peter's here Tuesday. Yes, it's World Radio Day today and CJSF's FM birthday. We first went on the air 21 years ago on February 13th. 2003, and we're still here today, and hopefully we're going to be here for many, many years to come. And so we're celebrating World Radio Day and our birthday today.
You kind of sprang that on me. But what existed for the campus radio prior to then?
Station's been around since about 1965, which is when the university opened, right? Prior to 2003, when we went on the FM band, we were available through cable FM, which in many ways is a very sort of archaic format. But it basically meant that we weren't broadcasting over the air, but we were broadcasting via the cable network. Back, of course, in the early 2000s, everybody had cable in their home. And if you were to hook your radio up to the cable network, you could also tune in FM stations.
So what was the big dividing point 21 years ago? What made it, when the changeover, what made it special?
What made it special is we started broadcasting over the radio with radio waves.
Over the air.
So that, up until that point, if someone was...
You were just a cable radio thing.
Yeah. So, if someone was doing their show here,
even
and they finished
1965?
Their show, and then they went to go home, they'd go out and get on the bus. They couldn't listen to the radio going home, or if they went and got into their car to drive home, they couldn't listen to the station because we weren't available.
Hmm. Well, sorry for interrupting you, but in 1965, was there the cable radio?
No. I think at that point, in 1965, the station was broadcast through some speakers in various places around campus. That was about it.
Oh.
They had, I don't know how many, and it wasn't that many. And they had basically what amounted to a little closet under some stairs in the rotunda part of the campus, which was probably about the size of the room we're in now, and that was about it. Started by some radio enthusiasts who were just really keen on radio, and they got some equipment and started doing stuff and went through various iterations. I think the cable broadcasting started around 1980 or so, sometime in the 80s. And then there were a couple unsuccessful applications for an FM license. And then finally we were successful getting the FM license in 2002 and started broadcasting February 13th, 2003.
When did the cable thing kick in? Did you say the 1980s?
Yeah, I don't know. Off the top of my head, I don't know exactly.
Okay, well, that's a strange... I didn't know it was just available on cable for a while.
Yeah. Yeah, and then there's another way, another strange technology called AM carrier current, which basically means you plug the FM signal into a building's electrical system, and then anyone who plugs their radio into the wall, it can pick up that signal. But only through the electrical system of the affected building. So, like, the residences here in campus for a long time had that, again, prior to the FM signal.
Well, I think we celebrated Radio Day by explaining all that.
We did.
Because that's quite involved.
It's a lot of stories. But we're very happy to be here in 2024. And hope for a long time to come. And, of course, things are changing nowadays. Now, not only do we have our FM radio signal, of course, we've been broadcasting over the internet for a long time. And in fact, that started, we were broadcasting through our website from about 1998, so before we went FM. And now we have which we still do, from our website at cgsf.ca. And then we now have a smartphone app. And you can download our app and listen to the live radio stream. You can find out about all our programming. And you can also, with a new version, new update that's coming up very soon, then you'll be able to listen to all the podcasted shows where programmers have uploaded their shows to the website. So, like this show, later this afternoon, I'll post it up to the website, and people will pretty soon be able to grab shows like that and listen to them at any time they like.
Yes. And this historic show.
And, the world of radio and technology and media is always changing, and we're doing our best to try and keep up. All right. On today's show, we're going to be talking about...
Karen Hudis, yep. Who died, actually, October 2022. Mm-hmm. I was sort of hoping at one point to have her on the station. She's from the United States.
But yeah. So what was she notable for?
Well, she was fired from the World Bank in 2007, and her contentions was about the Philippines. She was questioning. She was questioning what the arrangement was with the Philippines, with the World Bank. Actually, it started in 1999. She had made a. She had lodged that certain issues were coming on, but she was fired in 2007. And from 2007 to the time she died, she was a person that was on a variety of shows, not really mainstream, but she was known in some circles, actually.
Okay. Great. Well, we're going to come back to that in a few minutes.
Yeah.
We're also going to talk a bit about Trump and whether he should be in jail or not.
Okay.
A bit. And we have a really interesting documentary about Guatemala coming up later in the show. First, though, we have some music for you from Vancouver. This is The Golden Age of Wrestling, featuring Vancouver. It's sort of a personal project of Vancouver musician Jeff Kincaid. This is the third release from the band, and they just have the new record out in January. The track here is Ferrari Rocher from the Golden Age of Wrestling. the golden age of wrestling and Ferrari Rocher from a new album out here in Vancouver. All right, Peter.
Okay, so I'm going to talk about, first of all, Aquino, Carnes Aquino.
Corazon Aquino.
Because we got to, I didn't realize this would be an important thing. We're a bit older, Marco, so, I mean, you're a Magnus. You're a bit older.
I am not Ferdinand Marcos.
No, but you're...
Anyway,
I got your name as Magnus.
Yeah.
No, but it was a bit of popular culture when he... Marcos, we had to resign, and his wife had him all those shoes, if you remember.
Yes.
How the shoes were famous.
Yes. Imelda Marcos was famous for her shoe collection. And, of course, Ferdinand Marcos was the dictator of the Philippines.
Yes. Then we had Aquino. There we go.
Corazon Aquino.
Corazon Aquino. And she was only president till 1992.
And she was part of a popular movement that, in the end, overthrew Ferdinand Marcos.
Now, so what happened was that the person that took over as president, oh, boy. No, it was because, okay, what the person I bring up was the vice president.
Yeah.
Under this person.
Under Corazon Aquino?
No. The one that followed him. Anyway, darn this. Okay. He was vice president.
Yeah.
And he is Joseph Estrando.
Yeah.
So he was vice president from 1992 to 1998. Then he became president from 1998 to 2001. Actually, just January 20th, 2001. And actually, the person that was president when he was vice president was sort of the one saying, he basically had to resign, actually. So that was an interesting thing. He, now then, what Karen Hooters did a complaint, but she was employed at the World Bank from 1986 to 2007.
Right, and what position was she?
The position was in the legal department of the World Bank.
Right, okay.
Doesn't say specifically.
Yeah.
Now, so what it reads from her, I don't know why they still have the law office, the Karen Hooters, she died for about almost a year now. In 1999, Karen Hooters reported the corrupt takeover of the second largest bank of the Philippines. Lucio Tan, a crony of Joseph Estrada, who was president at the time, then president of the Philippines, acquired stock owned by government employees in the Philippine National Bank, valued more than 10% of the bank's outstanding capital without disclosure as required by Philippine security law. Tan owned Philippines Airlines in default of its loans from the bank. The government of the Philippines loaned $493 million to the bank after the bank's depositors made heavy withdrawals. $200 million of a loan from the World Bank and a $200 million loan from Japan have to be canceled. Thanks for allowing me to say that bit of technical information. But I wanted to have exactly what it was.
Yeah.
But her firing was in 2007. Mm-hmm. Now, what happened was that he was kind of put on a form of house arrest, Joseph Estrada, to 2007.
Right.
And then in September 2007, they actually said you have to spend so many years in prison. However, that was acquitted in that same year, October 2007. Now, that in 2007, that's when... she gets fired from the World Bank. And what happened was that this is from a legal document that actually was from 2011 because she attempted to have a lawsuit, civil lawsuit, didn't you tell me? Anyway, so... from that document, it said Karen Hooters requested that the bank's resident country director in the Philippines to inform the government of the Philippines that the waiver for the board of executive directors would be required in order to dispute the second and third parts of the bank's loan to the government. Now, what happened supposedly was that first they made her not, that wasn't her the apartment anymore, but the actual Philippines. And then, she continued stating, you know, that she thought there was a problem. And then they had, but they disclosed confidential records, medical records from her insurance company. And and then she complained about that. And then the medical doctor she was under went to the World Bank and said that she was unfit. She was psychologically unfit. And the contention is that the real reason he said that was because she had said he had broken some certain laws. However, now when the civil suit came forth, and a quote from it is that the World Bank is immune from such suits by McCursory and former employees. And so actually, the World Bank, what sort of found in it's a document, the World Bank is actually immune from a lot of lawsuits. They mentioned another person was the World Bank and got, they had a problem, and it was a sexual harassment and so on. It was mm-hmm. the same thing that they said that at the end, they enjoy a certain immunity from being persecuted or so on. So, and that was sort of the complaint Karen Hudis had. If you look at Karen Hudis, you're going to find a lot of the interview sheets. He goes into other topics, but the main thing that caused it was the criticisms we had about how the Philippines was basically being run economically.
Mm-hmm.
And she has sort of made, over the years, kind of outlandish things. I think the problem with her is that she has entertained too many things that she hadn't previously, because she does have she has a medical, a law background.
Mm-hmm.
And she studied law at Yale Law School and economics at the University of Amsterdam. And she worked at the U.S. Export-Import Bank of the U.S. from 1985 in the legal department at the World Bank from 1986 to 2007. But I think even though if you look at some of the interviews, sometimes he does get a bit outlandish, because he's not really sticking to the original thing that she was upset about,
right?
And the original contentions,
mm-hmm.
and she, I think, validly makes other points about the World Bank.
Right. So maybe just you can sort of reiterate, what were her concerns?
Well, the concerns was basically that, I know it was a bit of a legalese. At first, Philippines was being run, or?
Yeah, like what were the issues she raised that seemed to get her into trouble?
Well, basically, that something was wrong economically. It was actually that the pension funds were mm-hmm. being made off with.
Right, and of course, this would have been, you know, money supplied from the people.
I mean, I kind of said, I know the problem is that this what I read out. Reported the corporate, the corrupt takeover, the second largest bank in the Philippines. That was 1999. So, and it was the president at the time who was involved with that. Right. It seemed quite a bit of money. It was, anyway, I know I had read it, and I slightly understand that.
So you have some criticisms of the World Bank yourself.
Well, the World Bank was operating pretty well until 1968 when Robert McNamara became president. He was president from 1968 to 1981.
Right. And he'd been, previous to that, he'd been the Secretary of State or something?
Yeah, he's called the architect of the Vietnam War.
Yeah, because he was either the Secretary of Defense or the Secretary of State under the Democratic administration for Kennedy and then Johnson. Yeah.
I'm going to bring up something I didn't know about Robert McNamara a little
before you could do that, though. You were about to tell me about your concerns about the World Bank.
What happened was that he corrupted the bank, because the bank really was involved in the Third World up to that time. In fact, it had rescued Germany and Japan, even though they were on the wrong side. It was figured we're not going to have what happened in World War One and another war.
Yeah.
So they rebuilt Germany and Japan. I think McNamara wanted to prove, I did the Vietnam War, but I'm going to save the Third World. We got them in debt, basically. That's what he did. In fact, the last thing he did in 1981 was he signed a program for deforestation of the Amazon rainforest for a cattle ranching. And a lot of that went to the McDonald's, supposedly.
Right.
I guess they froze the beef or something. But so, no, I mean, and actually when I was hearing some of the interviews with Karen Hudasett, one person said when she came in 1986, it was a legal department. One person told her that the bank was okay until McNamara was came aboard.
Right.
One thing I want to say about McNamara, which I found out a little while ago, he sort of in the 1990s, he said, I was wrong about the Vietnam War, I was wrong about this. But there was a very shocking program he instigated. This was to have mentally challenged people drafted and sent to Vietnam.
Right.
And this was a program that went on till 1971. And what the concept was, they would be showing videotapes that would help them out or something. Mm-hmm. It was a completely disastrous concept. In fact, there was two parents of a child said, look, don't have this happen, and it didn't happen.
Yeah.
And it's kind of really forgotten about. But he never apologized. He to the, his death in 2009 said this was a proper program. I mean, so it's interesting people say, well, he admitted the Vietnam War was wrong, but why would you not go to the conclusion if someone's mentally challenged, they shouldn't be sent there? But he felt that was okay. So, Magnus.
All right.
And anyway, maybe I might, the next one, go into kind of deloading some of the other things Karen Hudas had to say, maybe what I agree and disagree with.
Right.
Because if you do, you will find some strange things. But anyway, that's report, and it took me a lot of effort to.
Thank you for that, Peter. Yeah. I think we'll come back and talk about the World Bank again sometime.
Okay, yeah, we'll do that.
All right. Peter Haskell. All right, so we have some great stuff coming up for you today on the show still, so I hope you will stay tuned. First, we're going to bring you Bird Note, and then we'll be back with a little bit about that orange guy, Donald Trump.
This is Bird Note. Some birds seem like they came straight out of the mind of a cartoonist. The keel-billed toucan, also known as the rainbow-billed toucan, looks like a bird with a giant banana for a beak. They have a black body, a yellow patch from the face to the breast, and a huge rainbow-colored bill. These tropical beauties flaunt their colors from the jungles of southern Mexico to Venezuela. Their songs set the mood at Mayan archaeological ruins, like those of Calakmul in Mexico. In Belize, the keel-billed toucan is so cherished that they named the species their national bird when they gained independence in 1981. The rainbow-billed toucan feeds mostly on fruits. They hold them with their beaks, tilt their heads backward, and chomp down. These toucans aren't skilled at flying, preferring to hop from branch to branch. They don't like being alone either. They move in groups of 6 to 30 birds. And when living together creates some friction, they use their beaks as swords and dueling. Those big beaks aren't just for fighting, though. All the blood flowing through the beak helps toucans regulate their body temperature in the tropical heat. So there's more than one way to use that impressive beak. For Bird Note, I'm Lucina Melesio.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, coming to you from the top of Burnaby Mountain. This is Speak Up for Tuesday, February 13th. My name is Magnus. With me today is Peter.
Yes.
So, Donald Trump is still running for president of the United States.
No, but how many states will in November he won't be on the ballot?
Well, that's one of the things that's, I think, being currently determined in a large number of court cases involving him. We can talk about a few of them. One of them, a couple of them are before the U.S. Supreme Court. Some of them have been, some of them are still underway. Some of them have been decided. He's already been lost in a civil case against E. Jean Carroll, who brought a civil case against him for sexual assault, which he lost. And in the wake of that, and he was a judgment of a couple million dollars of some sort, a few million dollars, a judgment against him, and kept talking about it and saying derogatory things about her, and she sued him about that and won that case for $84 million. Now he has to pay her $84 million. There's the issue of whether or not he can be on ballots in a number of states because of his role in the January 6th insurrection at the Capitol. The Supreme Court heard arguments about that last week. They haven't made a decision yet, although judging from the articles I read about it, from the questions they were asking the lawyers in the case who were making the presentations, doesn't sound like they're going to uphold those, mainly on the basis that it maybe shouldn't be states that are deciding who can be on the ballot for the federal election. I'm not enough of a legal expert to really determine whether that's legitimate, although I can see the point in not having every state making its own decisions around that in the current very polarized political climate. There's the charges in the January, he's actually being charged federally for his role in the January 6th insurrection. And that case is currently on hold because he's made a claim that as president he should be completely immune from criminal prosecution for anything he's done while as president, which seems kind of crazy on the face of it, and was roundly in a senior level of the District of Columbia court, a very high-level federal court. You know, they basically shot that argument down completely, which means it's now going to go to the Supreme Court. And it's a big question whether the Supreme Court will actually take the case if they do, that creates more and more delays because the criminal prosecution ends up being on hold while this specific point of contention gets decided at the higher